Who do you blame? Who do you blame for Peterson's like just total lack of understanding of what postmodernism is?
Who do I blame? I blame myself, obviously. I mean, okay, so okay, no, that's a cop out. So there are many factors there. And of course, it's partly him and partly the egregore of society that, you know, pushes him in that kind of direction.
Explain.
Both positions or just the last one?
What is an egregore?
Well, it's a, like a attractor of memes that is self-organizing in a kind of way and acts as, you know, like a vortex where it's very easy to, you know, apply yourself to a certain worldview, you know, so you get captured by some ideas, you get, you know, infected by ideas, and sometimes these ideas are good, and sometimes these ideas, these attractors, are kind of bad. And so what I mean is that I was actually thinking about this. So in regard of postmodernism, so you can have easily like a four quadrant approach to postmodernism. And so it's the academically useful and the academically useless and the culturally useful and the culturally useless. And so the debate basically never goes about the academically useful. That's not what happened in our culture. Then you have the academically useless, and that's, you know, what happened, you know, in the Sokol affair in the 90s, basically, where, you know, this, I think it was Sokol, no, who, you know, looked at postmodern academic texts and said, what bullshit that partly is, right? And so it's very easy to make a strong man out of that. And then you have the culturally useful aspect of postmodernism, which includes the civil rights movement and, you know, the question of social hierarchies and, you know, equality and all of these kind of arts movements and movements in architecture and all of this. And then you have the culturally useless. And that's the straw man thing you make out of cultural Marxism, basically. And all the things that, you know, the whole IDW kind of rails against. But this is, even if it would be true, it's only the quadrant of the culturally useless. And so, and that is a whole egregore, like a whole attractor of thought that kind of captures it, because it's like, it's very tempting to think that way about postmodernism. But what the cultural useless part thinks about the academic good thing of Lyotard and Foucault, for example, there's literally no overlap between these two things, right? Because it's two different vectors, let's say. And what Peterson did in a kind of way was, you know, latching on or get latched on, the more famous he got, by these egregores. Because, sorry if I'm rambling, but you asked me. So I was talking with Andrew about trigonometry, about this podcast. And, you know, if you start out always as at the avant-garde, as the margins of cultural discourse, you always like have kind of weird, let's say, parallax views on things. But the more famous you get, the more you get ushered in these great, you know, egregores, this great, you know, normative kind of ways of thinking about things. And now, if you look at trigonometry, where with their hundred thousands of subscribers and millions of views, they're just boilerplate right wing now, right? And it's like, that's the thing. And so that also happens with Peterson. And so in that way, people get captured the higher they ascend in the pyramid of, you know, social and the social strata and fame and stuff.
Yeah, I think, so I mean, also to an extent, they're captured by their own audience, right? Like they're trying to continue to engage the same people that have made them rich and famous. And so they become more and more responsive to what their audience wants to hear from them and the guests that audience wants them to bring on. I think there's an interesting phenomenon there with Joe Rogan, like as he moved further and further away from, you know, probably his first love, which was podcasting about MMA fights and so forth, you know, and so it's like it's made it kind of a weird mix. And so he moved away from those because what made him famous was like, you know, the culture commentary that he started to do and the guests that he started to have on. Trigonometry, I think like that ties in interestingly with Jordan Peterson, because Trigonometry had a guest on several years ago called Stephen Hicks. I'm not sure if you're aware of who that is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Stephen Hicks is. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I think Stephen Hicks was possibly the first one to make the connection between postmodernism and cultural Marxism, and like place the blame basically for what is being described in the modern context as cultural Marxism on postmodernism, and like vice versa, right? That one begat the other. And so I like, you know, the fact that Trigonometry interviewed Stephen Hicks at this like roughly the same time that Jordan Peterson was becoming quite famous. I wonder if similar, you know, like kind of like algorithmic, you know, like discourse capture, you know, like bots in the background brought Jordan Peterson to those same kind of I guess aggregors or memes or ideas, like culminating in this completely bizarre like music video called the Postmodernist Drinking Song that he just put out.
I mean, what I mean, yes, but I also, you know, there are two aspects that I think are interesting. First is like, there are not so many popular movements, especially, I mean, if you look at what happened 2 or 3 years ago or 5 years ago when Peterson blew up, basically, that was a moment of absolute coherence within the, you know, web sphere, because you could either be for it and or against it. It was part of every discourse, you know. And the other thing is that these people are highly competent. You know, if you look at, you know, Peterson is a great orator, and even the guy from Trigonometry, like they come off at first moment as some kind of clowns or nerds. But if you listen to them, and if you listen to the conferences there, and they're really highly educated, highly competent people, very articulate and very smart. And you don't find that prominent on the left side. And so you have like kind of, I mean, look just at Zizek. He can't really articulate himself properly without getting a stroke or something, you know? Highly articulate, highly very precise in their thinking, but you know, completely captured by these big vectors of thinking, these big attractors or egregores, you know.
And so you don't think? Do you think that they're true believers, or do you think that they're completely just like reflecting back to the audience what it wants to hear, or you know, are they actually captured and become true believers in during that process of sort of like compromising what you know to be true with what is expedient to believe about the truth in that moment?
I mean, it's an egregore, and so by sheer luck of the algorithm, I found a video of what's his name, Christopher Hitchens, in debate with Naomi Wolf, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Charlie Rose. It was like 1994, and they already had the same debate. It was the same debate, and so these egregores are just, you know, these big fields of thought. And at that point, you can't tell them the question is if they add something to the discourse. But I think they're completely captured by the ideological meme at the center of it. And the only question is like science, you know, you don't invent science. What you can do is you add some new insights or some things, you know, and science as an egregore, as an attractor, like Luhmann describes it, right? But the question is, of course, Peterson added something, otherwise he wouldn't have been that famous, because he was like giving something to the system what wasn't that was new before, that was new at that moment.
Or he was in the right place at the right time, saying the thing. I'm just not sure that he invented much of anything at all, you know, like he's a very capable an interesting, like, to me, he functions as a sort of like he like aggregates like really specific kinds of like knowledges and potentially maps meaning onto them. Do you know what I mean? And that is like some like shaman level, you know, shit to be able to do that, and then to also like, you know, speak the words that transfer that that knowledge into the minds of others. Like, that is absolutely, you know, next level to me. He does that more competently than Konstantin Kissin, which is the sort of like the smart one from trigonometry, or even, you know, like Douglas Murray or Stephen Hicks, for example, which both of them, I find them incredible orators, but they're more for me in the style of like an ideologue, you know, like they have this way of expressing themselves very forcefully, but I don't know that they're actually like converting anyone to their way of thinking. Whereas Jordan right. Peterson seems to be able to reach into all of the dark shadows of the discarded, you know, and explain to them why they're suffering, right. you know, and identify an enemy, whether that's a group of people, usually not, but sometimes it's ideas, right, that he identifies as like, this is the reason that you're suffering. And for Jordan Peterson, speaking to the disaffected, you know, pre-males, incels, you know, whatever, like that population, who are certainly intellectually capable, but aren't, you know, making themselves felt in the world the way that they expected to. I think Jordan Peterson does an incredible job of explaining to them like why they're not as powerful as they like should be on paper, or as they've been told that they that like the privilege accrued to them by the society that they're living in.
Yeah. I partly agree. You know, the part I think there are two Jordan Petersons in a kind of way. And so what I think is, when you say he doesn't add anything, I think that's true now. But he did add something. And so there's this whole theory that the question, I mean, we talked about this stages of consciousness, right? And so as who do you describe, you know, a certain phenomena? And Peterson 1 was, at least in my understanding, a kind of integral syncretistic thinker, in the sense that he was meshing together different ways of different system of knowledge, be it like philosophy or, you know, academic kind of psychology or Jungian psychology or Nietzsche or whatever. And he had a certain propensity for, you know, the hero journey into the abyss, you know, because that was his topic. And so that was, and the way he was synchronizing all these kind of knowledge systems, you know, Maps of Meaning is an amazing book.
Have you read it?
Yeah. And so, then came his crisis and, you know, his opioid dependency or whatever it was, you know, his comatose state of whatever that was. And then emerged Peterson 2. And Peterson 2 is not, he regressed in a kind of way, and he started to inhabit a different archetype. So the archetype is not, again, the hero that plunges into the depths of the unknown, but that of the trickster and the clown. And you see that actually, because he wears like this weird kind of blazer with the two colors. He's just missing like the head with the bling bling, you know? So it's really, and then he makes like this weird videos, and he completely regressed to the more postmodern or anti-postmodern modernistic state, because that's happened when you, because so the ideas that the stages of development are kind of tend to be more masculine or tend to be more feminine, right? So have you the integral, which is more tool oriented, you know, tools of consciousness and more masculine. And then you have the postmodern, which is more like communal oriented. And below that is the modernistic, which is again more tool and machinistic, industrial oriented. And before that you have the pre-modern, you know, church-like, communal oriented. And so when you regress, you know, on sometimes on the same scale. So you regress from the integral to the more modern. It's completely anti-postmodern now. It's like, and takes on this coat of the trickster. Yeah, I'm railing against postmodernism now, but only in the lower quadrants of culturally useless. And so that's like, it's to me a very strange transition from being somebody who was a Leary-like figure in, you know, seat of psychology in Harvard and mm-hmm. chair and, you know, interweaving all these different knowledge systems and then to this kind of trickster clown figure that cries a lot and makes weird music videos. So that's my basic gist of it, you know. So
yeah, I quite like his crying. I think that that's a sign of you know, like a well-integrated feminine and the ability to externalize emotion. All of that, I think, is potentially a sign of someone maturing, you know, well, I suppose. And I mean, it's easy to ridicule, and I wonder whether it's really just a form of like emotional incontinence or something, you know, like that he just
comes to Waterworks and you can, it's like you have to watch and it's 4 minutes and 30 seconds, here we go again.
Yeah but I mean, maybe Lobster Daddy needs more antidepressants. I don't know, you know, like maybe he needs to fuck anybody more.
He needs some good juicy pussy, that's what he
right
needs.
I mean, absolutely but he has this like interesting I'll say interesting relationship with his wife, whom he loves very much, who seems more like
but the one doesn't exclude the other. You know?
No, I mean, ideally not, but I would imagine for him it might, you know, like I don't know. Anyway,
sorry to interrupt, but just mm-hmm. that's the big difference between Leary and Peterson, because Leary knew how to fuck. You know, Leary was a completely full blown sexual being, you know, mm-hmm. where Peterson is not, so
yeah, there's no reports of him having any kind of, you know,
no reports of abuse or rape, nothing. You know?
I know, that's so disappointing. Like, yeah, is he even a man?
Yeah. Can he even be? Does he rape? You know, does he even rape? No, yeah. What's the thing? Does he lift? No, does he rape? No, so okay.
Yeah. I rape, therefore I am. That's the male.
I rape, therefore I am. Yeah, that's so. Thank the Lord that you said it, and not I. Okay.
I'm I can be misandrist all day long. No worries there. I can be counted upon to say the worst kind of shit. But so Jordan Peterson, yeah, no, his suit, you're making the case that it's like towards like a kind of jester, like being a court jester.
Yeah,
and that he's like I kind of thought he was moving towards like a Baptist preacher, you know, like tent revival Southern style, you know, like where we all get into our you know, ecstasis, you know, like some state outside of the physical self, you know, like that type of thing. And then I thought that emotionality, that like over emoting was his way to like get us there, to, you know, to feel something.
Yeah, but a Baptist wouldn't do a video like this, you know.
No, a Baptist wouldn't do a video. Okay, let's talk about the video. Should we talk about the video?
I mean just in general, you know, it's like, oh, maybe he code switches at some points, but I find this, you know, I was thinking in preparation of this podcast, you know, it's like there is this, at least partly, this element of the trickster that he wants to embody, or the jester or the clown. Sure. It's like this, mm-hmm. because these videos are preposterous, you know, mm-hmm. in every measure that you could apply to them. You know, it's like who does he want to address, and who does that? You know, it's like in a it's a Hail Mary mission, and there's only one archetype who does that, and that's the jester. You know, it's like I don't give a fuck. You know, I show you, I show you. You know.
Yeah, but there's, I mean, that's an interesting part of the fool's journey also, right? Like, and I mean, sometimes you can't identify where on that path that person is. Like, is he really the fool, or is he the magician, right? Or is he, like you said, he seems to be code switching.
Was it a Freudian?
That's only tarot.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, when in tarot, the fool is the hero. Like, that's card zero is you know, a young... you know, idiot looking at the sky, not seeing the cliff in front of him with his trusty dog and like all of his worldly belongings on the end of a stick in a sack, you know. But then like those elements, like as you were saying, he's like integrating a lot of things. Maybe it's just like in this moment he's integrating that inner child or that fool, or you know, what happens on the path of knowledge acquisition is that at a certain point you fall off of the top of Mount Stupid, right? Like you acquire knowledge and you start to think that you know some things, and then you kind of like get really quite like full of hubris. You start to think like, oh my God, I'm so smart and I'm attaining all of this you know, knowledge, and I'm practicing you know, meditation, and I'm into like occultic themes, and I can do magic, and I can
what
blah
is it
blah
with
blah
you today with tarot and all this today.
And then you fall off of the top of Mount Stupid when you realize something happens, and you realize, oh no, I'm so much a fool, like so much a beginner in knowledge acquisition, in, you know, in this particular like category or whatever, that I didn't even know how much I didn't know yet. And then the real learning begins, you know? Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah, but I don't think that's the case with Peterson. I mean,
you don't think that's the case.
I mean, I, you know, one thing I always hate is to do like, you know, distance diagnosis of people. You know, Obama is this and Merkel is that. And, you know, it's always shit to do this. But indulging nonetheless in this, in this way. No, what I think is that one thing you don't do with jesters. You can't hurt them. You know? It's like they are protected. They're protected by status of their role. And in the last 4 years, he got beaten so much that taking on the role of the jester protects him of being you know, the punching bag of the people.
Oh wow. That's, yeah, I mean, that's dark, but that does track. I just thought he was like relearning how to play. You know, I actually quite liked his video, as bizarre as it is.
Oh, see, it comes off like a little puppy, exactly.
Yeah, and
it,
I mean, and
the same thing. Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing. He can't be hurt. Oh man. I really wanted to think that it was very much you know, intentional, that he is, you know, doing his own self-authoring thing on himself, like that he's being more careful about his public self, that he's you know, like tailoring that persona for what its intended purpose is. I don't know. I thought he did a good job in the video.
The problem is that normal people like me, I can't understand what he's going through, or is had been, you know, what he experienced. And then on that kind of level of public exposure and fame and money and all of this, and then this whole drama, it's very hard to really understand and to walk in his shoes, basically. Because while you were just saying this, I was reminded to the fact that Leary had the same mechanism at one, because he was like thrown into jail because of, you know, a spliff, whatever, like a tiny joint or like a bag of weed or whatever. And so it was deemed the most dangerous man in America by Nixon, later, you know, thrown into, you know, jail next to Charles Manson and all of these kind of things. And in between, he decided he will only laugh in public. You know, he will always, you know, wear a smiling face. And that's kind of it's the same mechanism, you know, that when you have that kind of level of exposure, so you have to deal with that in a kind of way to find a mechanism to deal with this, you know?
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I've always thought that Americans are very infantile in their insistence on being authentic everywhere, you know, like bringing their real self to every conversation, which usually amounts to some sort of like cringy self-exposition or trauma dumping, or like, you know, suddenly you know way more than you ever wanted to know about that person, all for the sake of, like, I think a lot of those people are just like outsourcing their, you know, like psychiatric care or whatever, you know, like they're finding counselors wherever they can because they have no like health coverage, you know, like at parties, if like people end up telling you things about their deepest selves, you know, or if they feel offended because during a meeting you didn't greet some, you know, some idea of theirs in a completely enthusiastic way, and then they take it personally, you know. And my question there is always like, what are you doing showing up fully as your vulnerable, authentic self to any public situation? Like, first of all, nobody owes anybody their true self, right? You just have whatever that is. And also, like, authenticity also has, like, you can't just be like lazy. You can't just show up and like not have any filters and be authentic that way. Well, authenticity.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well. Yeah. Yeah. I guess. Yeah. Yes. Also, with the help of a lot of drugs. Like, if we're talking about the psychedelics era, people, I'll take Hunter S. Thompson over Timothy Leary, actually, to be honest with you.
Right.
Because I think Hunter S. Thompson was a total like chaos magician, actually.
Of course, he was.
Yes. But anyway. Anyway. But we're talking about Peterson, who's none of those things. And I'm not sure, you know, that his, like, I don't know. I take your point, and it would be a very good, strategy for him to start externalizing an aspect of himself that is the jester that can't be hurt, that's always laughing in public, or overly emoting in the other direction.
The weird thing again is that, you know, going back, that he, with all of this, decided just go for the culturally useless postmodern stuff, because that has been done to death in the last 40 years, right? And that he's not, with his all his of his intellect and all his accolades and all his public exposure, he's not able or not willing to see the cultural good stuff and the academic good stuff, so that he's not able to bring that into this conversation. That's kind of weird. So that he is so you know, full of himself in a kind of way, that he actually goes on stage with Zizek and tries to talk about Marxism without only superficially having read the Communist Manifest, if ever. And so it's like, so what is that?
Well, and Zizek was so generous with him. I love that debate. Yeah. It's such a masterful, like, an intellectual being very relaxed about this challenger who doesn't know shit. You know, Zizek could have really, you know, rolled him over 1,000 times and just fucked him. But he was just like so generous. He was like, oh, no, that's okay that you haven't, that you don't know this. It's okay. Like, let's keep talking. That was really beautiful. But we were talking before you started recording, we talked about you had picked up an old book that you had of Nietzsche, and you said you translated something that he'd said about women learning to hate at the same moment that they no longer capable of enchanting. I wonder if that's what happened to Peterson with postmodernism, because I think that he was actually very, very much a postmodernist. Like, I think he comes from that tradition, right?
Obviously.
Yes.
How can you be? How can you not be like, he was in the psychology department mm-hmm. of Harvard for 20 years. Like, mm-hmm. that's the hub, that's the container for postmodern academic thought. So, and you will tell me that he does not know the game, you know, to its dot or whatever. It's super mm-hmm. weird.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So like deconstructionism, totally a tool that he employs, you know, many, many times over, right? Totally a postmodernist tool. Questioning regimes of truth, right? He totally does that on every level, all of the time. Social construction of reality, he kind of phases in and out of that. But I think that he truly believes in an intersubjective reality. Like when you hear him really describe his philosophy, like deeply, I think that forms part of his like belief system. Power as productive, like that's totally his thing. Like he believes power is productive and should be potentially like wielded in a certain way and responsibly and whatever. Like all of these, he is a postmodernist. And then probably at some point, postmodernism moved on without him, or he failed to enchant in some way, and then he learned to hate. You know.
I mean, there are different, that's what I differentiate between, you know, there's cultural postmodernism, there's academic postmodernism. I doubt that he really read the postmodern academic philosophers, you know, I somewhat doubt that because, you know, the way he talked with Zizek was in a kind of way, the same way that Joe Rogan talked to Thaddeus Russell. It was basically the same kind of thing, because if you're actually engaging with a postmodern academic, you know, and like a well-versed academic, like a modern thinker can't really compete with that. That's why it's postmodern. That's because they have the better arguments. You know, and so and Thaddeus Russell was also very generous. Joe Rogan, to Joe Rogan, but there was just a level of thinking that Joe Rogan couldn't ascend to, you know, and you have, as Peterson also said, you have to give the devil its due. There are some ways of some methods, some modes of thinking, strategies of knowledge generating that are superior in postmodern thought, right? And I kind of doubt that he ever Peterson that he ever contended with those. I kind of doubt that he read Baudrillard and that he really read Foucault. I kind of doubt that. And even, you know, even, I mean, Lacan denies being a postmodernist, although you could say that he's kind of a kind of postmodern psychologist also, you know? And so all these kind of things, I don't know. I think what he read was the cultural, reception of the good and the bad. And the argument.
I mean, even if that's true, I mean, I think that if you sort of like do the, you know, like follow the flow, like follow that flow chart. And I mean, as a clinician, he'll be used to like digging deeply for the source of the problem, right? Like if we have a symptom, what is it caused by? What's like the deeper root of that symptomology? I think if he at any point identified, identitarianism, which is probably where his schism came from, was like being asked to use pronouns, right? In his class as a professor at University of Toronto, I think that's when he became famous anyway, is like his refusal to use any number of pronouns.
Correct.
It's not correct?
No. He never
When did he become?
No, he never refused to use pronouns. Never.
No.
His issue was that he had a issue with the legislation that you're like by law obliged to use them, which is
compelled speech, totally.
Yeah, if you look at Kohlberg's levels of moral hierarchy and moral development, that's a higher concerned than just me being forced to use pronouns or not. If you think on a legislative global level, that's a higher, that's callback four or whatever.
No, that's totally fair. And yes, agreed. That's a much, much deeper motivation. So if it, in that moment was his schism with postmodernism through its application in like identitarianism,
right?
Which is what made pronouns necessary and what made enforcement of pronouns necessary. He would have traced that back through Judith Butler, right? And Judith Butler was the one who brought, like, if we take your quadrant idea, you know, from like shitty postmodern academic slash like, you know, theory side into praxis, into like culture, that's Judith Butler. And then through Judith Butler, you have Michel Foucault, and then you have Derrida and others. Yes.
Well, I would always locate her in the academic useless, really. To use
right.
that.
Right. So, but for whatever reason, yeah, she brought that into that sort of like lefty campus activist popular consciousness.
Right.
The idea of of poor kind of like porous identities, intertextuality, right? Like dismantling of meanings, etc. Right, like that started to be practiced in like a fairly dubious way, you know, on campuses all over the West, and then became a kind of like a thought movement. I would posit, yeah.
Right.
And I so that I think if we're looking for why Peterson has such a problem with postmodernism, it might be personal. It might be because that is like the kernel of the schism between him and his like academic
but
career.
How petty can you be, really? I mean, like, who doesn't have problems when something gets personal, especially if you are a thinker or academic? You know, being academic means you can distance yourself from the equation. That's all what the training is for, the academic training, that you're not letting, you know, the personal get in the way of your academic studies. And, you know, so that's what it is. That's the whole thing.
Well,
except
in postmodernism and in you know, gender and identity, you know, programs all over the West and sociology programs all over the West, the personal became political in the late 90s, early 2000s.
But that already was, you know, an iteration of the true postmodern theory. That was not academic useful. That was academic useless. You know, that was already like a...
I disagree completely.
Like a degree. Okay, so, you know, if you stack that up and level it, you know, so if you just look at the academic useful, right? So what is that? One example would be systems theory and its origin. So, for example, so there was a guy, like a mathematician and psychologist called George Spencer Brown, right? And he developed this immense powerful calculus, Laws of Form, a book which is basically unreadable. But it was super important because he founded that, he created a calculus which starts with the observation. Every mathematical operation rests in observation and drawing a distinction. So he made a switch where it's not just a mathematical logical operation, but you have to include your way of observation and of drawing distinctions into that whole thing. And out of that, you know, all the systems theory, Maturana, autopoiesis, you know, these concepts, Luhmann, all of that emerged in the wake of this first new, you know, of this first new idea, and a whole kind of new way of thinking emerged. And out of that, you know, that the, you know, became a new way of, okay, what are social systems? What are nervous systems? What is psyche? And can you really differentiate between the systems, and what do they do? And that's what I mean. So all this thinking came afterwards of the, you know, the personal became psychological, you know, the become personal.
Political.
So it's an iteration of a way deeper, more profound theory that, you know, underlies it. You know, it's an iteration, and it's like it's a degradation of the original useful kind of approach, because systems theory, you know, we can't live in this network society without systems theory. It's like, it's impossible. Like everything that you do is influenced by it, like be it computers or way we think about social systems or everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, so, I agree there. And clearly the interconnectedness of knowledge systems but the fidelity drops off, right? As it's yeah. replicated and as it's and then you introduce more and more like fuzz, more and more static into that signal. So in terms of the personal being political and I just like the late 90s, early 2000s, postmodernism, one of the for me useful aspects of that movement that like kind of rose like a tide through academia was really like to sort of like interrogate ivory tower like hierarchies. And I think that was very useful, you know, to wash clean some of those ivory towers that had been completely ossified. And we're starting to become so theoretical and so bizarre that there's no like touching even like intermittently with praxis or with reality or with actualizing codifying anything in a way that would make it actually like doable. Like do you know what I mean?
Sure, but I mean this four quadrant model that I just invented because I was going to the toilet basically, and I had this idea. It's just like an approximation. What I just meant is with the academic useful would be in this case would be Foucault. And Foucault's mm-hmm. analysis of power structures in school, in discourse, in prisons, wherever. Whereas what you say that might have been useful, but that's not quite what I mean. It's like that's a derivation, that's an application of the theory of Foucault, mm-hmm. let's say, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, okay. Absolutely. Yeah. So and so in Peterson's song, like his first verse is devoted to shitting on Michel Foucault, right? So I'm going to assume that this represents some kind of hierarchy in Peterson's mind of who are the worst offenders in postmodernism.
Yeah.
Or what do you think?
No, it's absurd.
It's absurd. You're like, you don't even want to do like a text analysis. You're like,
oh, you want to do a text analysis. Okay, no, I know, but I don't know the text. I don't
you don't know the lyrics? Okay, so verse one, Michel Foucault was a genuine pervert and it made him awful sad. He invented philosophical doctrines designed.
So that's a lot of hearsay and allegations. There's a lot of allegations.
Right.
But there's nothing proven. I think he was... I mean, I think, was he gay? Which is not a perversion nowadays.
I mean, so he himself wrote about being really happy in Morocco because you could just pop down to the local graveyard and a nubile young man would present himself to you as a European for the use of his backside. So Michel Foucault wrote openly about taking part in the street sex trade in Morocco during his time there. So exactly. So what? I also don't. So what's shocking to me here is that first of all, Peterson is very much against cancellation. Right? So, but he's like canceling Michel Foucault. He's very much against like public shaming and all of this kind of stuff and like airing of like unsubstantiated claims, and yet that's the first verse of his song is doing that to an ideological enemy.
Especially all of his heroes are, you know, by that measurement, all of his heroes are perverts, because perversion mm-hmm. is what drives what drives us, what drives art, what drives, you know, knowledge acquisition and everything. It's called libido. And he should know that because he's a fucking psychologist.
Nice. yeah, designed to drive us all quite mad. So that's those are like serious accusations, you know, that Michel Foucault was like deliberately not just like obscurantist, but was like trying to dement like Western thought and Western minds.
Well, that's straw man. He was doing that. He was questioning power hierarchies and the West, whatever that is. But again, it's like you at some point, I always say, so you have the academic modernistic mindset of inquiry, of scientific inquiry, and the basic meme which is embedded in there, that you take an object and you deconstruct it. That's what modernistic science is. You take, you know, a piece of wood, and then you look at it and you try to look deeper and deeper and deeper of what that piece of wood actually is. And so that's a mindset. And what postmodernism did was take this and just applies it on science itself and culture. So that's nothing new, right? It's like, it's just hijacking that very process and like supercharging it. And it's like, basically he's criticizing himself with that thing.
Right. Yeah. No, and that is the postmodernist like application. And I mean, but if I ever am in like a seminar and I hear, let's unpack that, or let's interrogate that, or that's problematic.
Yeah.
And then I know that it's a postmodernist leading the seminar. We're going to be talking about some bullshit.
No. I don't think so. And that's, you know, there are some things that I, you know, that are just not true. I don't. So there's a, how do I say this? There's like a being postmodernism by default because you got hijacked by certain ideas, as we talked in the beginning. You know, there's an egregore. You're kind of hijacked, but you can, as you know, developmental psychology has shown again and again that you can even have a pre-modern mindset, right? And you can be get infected by postmodern ideas. They just hijack you. And that's what happens with, you know, people that are queer and now showing their true colors by voting for Palestine, you know, because they're actually on the same level of cognitive development, right? So you can also get hijacked by postmodern ideas when you're a modernist, right? But you can also, on the flip side, being a true postmodernist means that you have a certain kind of stage of development, right? And that there are two different ways of thinking about postmodernism. It's like you can either emulate or be get hijacked by postmodern memes, let's say, or you get to a stage of cognitive development which has been described again and again and again by people like Kugreuter or by Keegan or by thousands of developmental psychologists that says, yes, there's a stage of cognitive complexity and you can roughly map that with postmodern philosophy, roughly, not completely, but roughly, right? And so the majority of postmodern youngsters in school, they're not even modern, you know, because you need a certain age and a certain development, and you have to go through certain crisis to actually get to that kind of cognitive complexity that enables philosophies like that of Foucault, right? So there's a disconnect there.
we went like way off.
No, but you get what I'm saying. It's like, you know,
into
it's like
the weeds. All I heard was queers for Palestine.
I know. I threw that in there. No, but that's the explanation, you know?
Is that they're stuck on a certain postmodernist. I mean, when something becomes like patently and obviously destructive of the self, I have to wonder at the brain's capacity to continue to assert itself and its version of reality over, you know, like real material threat, you know, like those. Well, talking about Queers for Palestine, there was like a group of people that actually attended a pro-Palestine rally with their gay flags and were like, yay, we're with you, brothers,
people,
and got beat up.
That was like whole groups of masses of people, of left-wing, you know, idiots that were like, right. Kind of,
Yeah. So for someone like that, like to like, regardless of what like stage of cognitive development you're at, like if you're, I don't know. I mean, I think it's just delusion. I don't know about making it any more magical or interesting than that. Like, I think it's just like a completely deluded, non-real, like Candyland like world that they're living in, which is probably mostly online. And then, like, you know, they trot out into the streets to hoist some gay flag at a Palestine rally. I don't know if it's any more, like I said, like, I don't know why we're giving them the benefit of being at any particular cognitive stage of development rather than just being fucking deluded.
Yeah, but the problem is we are living in this world, and I'm questioning my own sanity, you know? So you have the same people that argue in the vein that, okay, you know, a tiny country like Ukraine was attacked, viciously attacked, by the way. And so now we have to give Ukraine all the weapons to defend themselves, right? Mm-hmm. And not to give in. We will never give in with Ukraine.
Fight, you know? To the last Ukrainian, yeah.
And
I'm
then
sure.
The same people to refuse to, you know, have the same perspective on another country, which is very tiny. A tenth of Germany being viciously attacked from people that engulf them, that, you know, want to kill them, have their agenda for years now to exterminate them. And we don't give them the right, or, you know, these people don't give them the right to defend themselves. And so it's like, with what kind of measure do you go to these kind of, do you observe these kinds of phenomena? And it breaks my mind in a kind of way that is like, what, I don't understand how you can have different measurements for basically the same, because the same, you know, sociological phenomenon. Because you could say, oh, no, Israel was kind of aggressive and was kind of waging war and territorial war for the last, let's say, 15 to 20 years, right? Mm-hmm. But then I think, oh, no, that also happened in the Ukraine. They were waging war for 15 years against the Russians that were living in the Ukraine. So where exactly is the difference? I don't see that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So,
well, I mean, but you're actually engaging with knowledge. Like you're not. I mean, I think that people aren't trying to look at anything. Like they're just being told what to think by their in-group. And, you know, it's flag Twitter. They're just like changing their, you know, like online name and adding like another flag, the current thing, you know, like
the NPCs or what's it called? You know,
when people NPCs,
get hijacked. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes. And I mean, I do think like anti-Semitism is like a major mind virus. And I think that it's a lot to do with actually kind of like the Zionist position of superiority, right? Like kind of the, you know, you're mad because you're not us, and that's probably true, but also, hey, how about maybe you should be less you know, vocal about being God's chosen people, and how there's no entry into that the grace of that company, and maybe some of the things that some of your leaders say about the Goy are maybe a little bit rough, you know. How about all of those things can coexist, but I can still be pro-Israel just on the basis of like fact of like what is happening there and who's responsible for it. But like, yeah, the kind of like modern left eating itself over various issues, like, you know, also just being pro-war to begin with is completely unbelievable to me. And you know, Ukraine, right? Like all of the modern leftists want the military industrial complex to start grinding out more weapons for more war in Ukraine.
Like that's a
leftist position now. Like, we're pro war.
No, but
now.
I can tell you where it comes from, and you know, that's one of these things, because you can ask, so what is the meme behind that? And it's you know what I mean, there was, like, I think in the Bush years there was, you know, there's a term for this, it's something to do with deterrence. What is you enforce military engagement in order to, what is Abschreckung? Abschreckung, yeah, to create a deterrence so that it will never happen again, basically. You know, so you have to overreact, basically, in order for everybody to constitute the same boundaries, you know, to accept those boundaries. And so it's like, that's okay when the Ukraine does it. It's certainly okay if the US does it, you know. But, you know, if Israel does it, you know, I mean, obviously overreacting completely. But why? Why would they do that? The only reason why they're completely overreacting is so they won't do that again.
Okay. I mean, right? I think one of the other reasons that they're completely overreacting is that, you know, the weapons need to be spent, right? Like the,
right.
The
okay,
enormous...
That would be the deep... of course.
Yeah. And, you know, and Bibi Netanyahu is having certain problems internally that, yeah, also need to be laid to rest, you know, and and there needed to be a unifying moment, you know, for the Israeli people. I mean, I also think that Western leftists think that when they're pro-Palestine, they're like on the side of the people of color. You know, I think I've seen like this whole like idea of like, oh, these are the like the downtrodden, you know, like people of color in that area.
Yeah.
Like, and then Black Lives Matter came out pro-Israel. Did you see this? What's left of that organization is like, no, we're pro-Israel. It's just a complete shit show. Now, what Westoids don't understand is that, like, inside the Israeli Jewish population, there are like many sub-ethnicities that are darker than most Palestinians, you know, like Mizrahi and Sephardic Jews. And, you know, like there's it's not just like these, like, you know, for all intents and purposes, white appearing, like, you know, European Ashkenazi Jews there. There's like a very diverse population in Israel.
It's not necessarily a question of, you know, color of the skin, but of the, you know, of the, again, of the system of, we talked about this, about, you know, humanism, secularism, industrialism, capitalism, all these things that happened with the Enlightenment and, you know, the system that Israel adopted and kind of lives by, although, you know, having all these kind of minority groups and whatever, but it's still having that system, you know, normatively. And and Palestine has not, and that's it. That's as simple as
agree. So speaking of like racism and racists,
so we
that's
want to
the
talk
next
about,
part
oh, sorry,
of the verse.
What's the next verse of no, because we're going on the tangent.
Yeah.
What's the next
no,
verse?
No, not really. The next part of the first verse is, critical racists now annoy us. They accuse and satirize, multiplying all around us. It's time we cut them down to size. So critical race theory was a thing for a minute, right? And it was like a whole controversy. It was being taught in schools and it's actually racist. There's a reverse racism.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. But again, any of those, like, you know, queer theory, any kind of critical theories, they do come from the postmodernist tradition.
Right.
Right. But I mean, again, it's kind of, he's fighting this, I'm not sure if it's a straw man or some kind of opposite, but like, critical race theory is useful in its context and maybe should be engaged with, you know, in a more like, what I'm failing to understand about Jordan Peterson is he has the intellectual capacity to actually engage with these ideas and, you know, and like tear them down properly. But instead of that, he's really giving them a very surface treatment, you know, like he's engaging with the meme, not the content. Like, it's form.
Yeah, but that's what
content.
I'm saying. He does that all the time. He did this all the time.
Yeah.
With postmodern ideas. That's the weird thing, that she, that you should, you know, suppose that, you know, or assume that he has the intellectual capacity to have an honest, you know, engagement with these theories, but he doesn't. And that's the weird thing to me. So why even engage on a mimetic level with yeah. this? It's like I don't see it. I don't see why. I mean, that's that.
Lucrative, yeah. Yeah. That's what I'm gonna assume is has become the driving force, right? Is just I don't know, but the video is too bizarre to be about making money. That's the thing, is like, I think it's too bizarre to be.
No, but it's a business.
Like commercial.
It's obviously like something you can spend your day with, you know, pushing that business and, you know, reacting. I don't want to be mean. I don't know that family, but there's something. You know, I was like, that was so funny. I was just sending that to a friend of mine because there was a video of Michaela, and she kind of, you know, because of all her surgery, she kind of looks like a man now. And I was like, wouldn't be the funniest thing if she transitioned to become a trans man and, you know, wants her father to call, you know, use like masculine pronouns on her. That would be so, that would be the icing on the cake, really. Really?
Well, she's named after Mikhail Gorbachev, so it's not far off, you know. She just has to drop the A on the end of her name. So
there's something going off. I mean, it's like the weird, you know, it's, I did once an interview with him, which was lovely, really. And I mean, it was Peterson One. We did an interview with his wife, also like a lovely, lovely lady, really. And so on a personal level, you know, I can't really say anything, but, you know, on this mimetic level, on this societal discourse level, it's just, it's weird things going on. It's like, and maybe the weirdest thing is that the left doesn't even have like a proper response to all of this, you know?
No, they don't. They just want to call him homophobic and like, just like use the usual slurs, right? But like not actually, you know, engage substantively with anything that he says. I do find that interesting.
So it's just, you know, a mimetic, you know, Maginot line, like a mimetic war, culture war. But on this, you know, because like I think the really interesting people, they're not engaged in this public, you know, charade basically, you know. So
thank goodness for that. Anyway, I don't know. I'm looking at more.
I don't know. I don't know what that makes us, like some third grade, you know, opinion spouters, you know, whatever. So,
yeah. Carrion eaters, you know.
Huh?
Carrion eaters, you know, vultures. Vultures.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the famous line in Unbreakable with Bruce Willis at the end when Mr. Glass, do you know that movie?
I didn't watch it. Now that you know that I know who you are, I know who I am.
Yes.
That line? Yeah, okay. That's been quoted to me.
You have listened to my podcast.
I did that too, but
rehash all my own ideas again and again and again.
Mm-hmm. They're good ideas sometimes.
But it's true. So it's like Mr. Glass. So the story, I don't know, I spoiled the whole movie now. So it's Bruce Willis plays a superhero who doesn't know who he is, and Mr. Glass is a kind of guy, you know, who has like this weird condition where he has glass bones and he doesn't know why he has all, you know, why he has this bad fate, you know. And so he looks for his opposite, you know, a guy who is unbreakable, like a Superman kind of guy who doesn't know that is Superman. And so he makes him know that he shows him in the course of the movie that he's Superman, basically. And in the end, he says, now that we know who you are, I know who I am. And it's such a movie. It's one of the great movies. That is, it's a fantastic movie. But now that we know who Peterson is, we know who we are. We know we are vultures.
but he's a vulture himself, you know, like he's,
well, that's what I mean, we're third grade, you know, we don't
third
even,
grade, yeah,
yeah, we don't even, oh, rape, so,
mm. We don't even rape, I know, how disappointing. I've been driving a lot across the prairie, and there's all kinds of animals are on the move because it's autumn, right? I live in a place that has seasons, unlike some people.
I don't know what you're talking about.
And wild animals. Yeah. So if you're driving at night, you have to be careful because the deer are on the move. And so you might smash into a deer. Mm-hmm. And also the predators attendant on them, also moving around. So I saw in the space of like, I don't know, about 100 kilometers, I saw a dead deer by the side of the road, a dead skunk by the side of the road, and then a coyote. So that's the predator that came to eat the dead things off of the road. Also himself was struck by a vehicle, and he was getting picked apart by crows.
Hmm.
So it's like, those, you know.
Where are those? Yeah. We all belong to the same ecosystem, that's for sure. You know?
Yeah. Just feasting on old ideas.
And so that's the eternal cycle, because some weird postmodern academic in the basement of his mother, because he can't do anything, he scrolls the internet for some weird new ideas and suddenly finds this shitty podcast and then builds a new theory, and the whole circle goes on and on and on. And on and on. So that's our purpose, you know?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. To catalyze the new things, you know?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. As we're like picking out the eyeballs of the dead coyote that is Jordan Peterson's ideas.
Worms ourselves, yes.